It's time for a bonus show, only for the supporters. Shout out to all my supporters on the Patreon, on the VIP, on the Rockfin. We're going to do some bonus material. As I do for the supporters, you get a little extra deep dive into some of these subjects since you care so much more than the free feed, losers. A joke. I kid. For real, the idea that we want to take a deeper look at today is Eyes Wide Shut. We already talked about the film. I did the analysis for everybody over two episodes. But today on the bonus episode, this is going to be the Eyes Wide Shut deep dive part three. We're going to start our review of Dream Novella. This was the book written by Arthur Schnitzler. This was the book that Kubrick read in the 60s. And he wanted to make a film out of it ever since then. And it turned out to be his final film, his final message. So I think we should take a look at the source material. Because to me, the important thing to look at here is that there are some discrepancies, some differences between the novel and the final product, the film. Will it add to the mystery that is Kubrick, to the secret Kubrick's code, the symbolism, the hidden messages he was trying to reveal to us? I believe so. There's going to be some wild, wild revelations. And without further ado, we're going to get into it. First, let's talk about Arthur Schnitzler, the old Schnitzler. This guy wrote some books. Lived from 1862 to 1931. Put that in perspective. He's old-timey. That's old-timey right there. He was associates with Sigmund Freud because his stories all had elements of sexuality in them. In fact, he was labeled as a pornographer. There are many claims about this guy. One was that he kept a diary from age 17 until the day he died. And supposedly recorded every orgasm. And then in another reference, another source I read that it was, he recorded every orgasm for like a certain period of time, like over a year or something like that. Now, what does that look like to record and write down about your orgasm? I don't know. Didn't get my hands on that. Now, Arthur Schnitzler, he was Jewish, and his penchant for sexual tones in his books, which of course labeled him a pornographer, right? It was used against him by Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler called it Jewish filth, adding to his bigotry and his hatred. And the Nazis, they were doing the book burnings. They tossed in Einstein's books and Freud and Karl Marx, because, you know, they hated the communists. Well, they also threw in Arthur Schnitzler's Dream Novella, which Stanley Kubrick would later make a great film. Now, Eyes Wide Shut, of course, is based off of Schnitzler's book, and it has a couple titles. It's called Rhapsody, a Dream Novel, a.k.a. The Dream Story, a.k.a. Traum Novelle, a.k.a. Dream Novella. Different phrases for the same book. And the characters you need to know. And it follows pretty close to the movie in the plot and how it progresses, the scenes, all that stuff. So, like, if you've seen the movie, you can pretty much tell what the book is going to be like. So I'm going to assume, my dear listener, that you've already actually watched the movie, or you've at least listened to my two-part episodes where I broke down what is in the movie. That's all you need to know. Because I'm not going to walk you through the whole book and scene by scene. I'm just going to assume you've seen the sequence. Now, in the book, we've got a guy named Fridolin. Like Frito-Lay. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Fridolin. Fridolin. This is Dr. Bill, okay? That's the protagonist, Dr. Bill. Albertina is Fridolin's wife. That's Alice. And I'll give you a couple reminders at the beginning, and then I'll take off the training wheels. There's the military officer that Albertina wants to bang. He's referenced as the Danish military officer. And like I mentioned in my Eyes Wide Shut analysis, he was not specified as a naval officer. That was something Kubrick came up with. We've also got the triple goddess, in effect. Albertina, of course, is Alice. But we've got Marianne. That's Marion from the film. She's the crone where her dad dies. We've got Mitzi. This is the prostitute. This is the same as Domino from the movie. The prostitute that tries to lure Tom Cruise in and turns out she's got the HIV. We've got Nightingale. That's Nick Nightingale from the movie. And the daughter. Oh, I didn't catch the daughter's name. We'll catch the daughter's name here in a minute. So let's get into it. Let's get into the book. And the big picture, again, just to reemphasize, this is very much like the movie. However, very curiously, they don't go into detail in this book on the orgy scene. They don't talk about a Gnostic mass in the book. The biggest part of Eyes Wide Shut, and it's not even in the book. It's a little bit implied. And of course, this is old-timey, so they really couldn't go too hard in the paint on this kind of stuff. But I found it very curious. There was no orgy scene. There was no Gnostic mass. No consorts. Even though they were calling Schnitzler the pornographer of Jewish filth, the books weren't that filthy. It wasn't the wet-ass pussy. It was the Jewish-ass filth, apparently. Anyway, the book is fairly accurate to the film. We're going to follow along. Now, the first line of the book, when you open it up, part one, the first sentence, 24 brown-skinned slaves rowed the magnificent galley, which was to take Prince Amgiad to the Caliph's palace. The prince, wrapped in his purple cloak, lay alone on the deck, gazing up at the dark blue starry night sky. And basically, it's Fridolin and his daughter, they're reading a book together, right? Now, what's curious here, the prince wrapped in his purple cloak. That should remind you of the young girl at Malik's Rainbow Fashions when she whispers in Dr. Bill's ear, he should wear what did she say? Something about a cloak with the ermine lining. And this is the same thing. But even more curious, this quote comes from a book, not specified in this story, but I Googled it. Actually, I DuckDuckGo'd it. I tried DuckDuckGo. Most of the time it works. Half the time, garbage results. I think this time it worked. It's from 1001 Nights. And why does that matter? Well, this goes back to the secret societies. It seems that Schnitzler put this reference in there to the secret societies of the assassins. Now follow along with me here, because I'm going to give you a little breakdown of the assassins. We've talked about them a couple times. I did a little bit deeper of a research on it. And here's the gist of it. You go back to 1090 AD, and you got these people called the Assassins. These were the Middle East Secret Society, and they were called that because they used to take out their enemies, they used to assassinate them. Hence the term, which derived originally from a term for hashish, supposedly. Now, there's a guy named Richard Spence, and he's a genius on secret societies, and I took some notes from him. And he said, this goes back to the first schism of Islam with the Shia and the Sunnis. And the argument back then was all about who would be the caliph, who would reign as the successor to Muhammad. Some people wanted his son-in-law, Ali, to take over, which made some think that that Muhammad would be establishing a royal bloodline. That's the Shia. Shia means the sect of Ali. Shia Ali, right? Now, the Shia group, they splintered out, arguing over who was the rightful imam and, again, royal bloodline stuff. And they became the persecuted minority. Some went underground as a secret society. And when they went underground, they employed tactics that we would later find in many secret societies of the Illuminati and such, called dissimulation. This was, the term was taqiyya. And the idea was you could conceal and lie about your allegiance in order to protect yourself. It was acceptable. The ends justified the means. And they started using these secret handshakes and the coded language. This was like the inception of a lot of these secret society techniques. This all happened in the Middle East. Now, there was a guy named Hassan Isabah, and he was the master of the assassins for a period. And he taught this secret inner group the secrets he learned at the ancient mystery schools in Cairo. And this is kind of just like Pythagoras, who was like kind of the first guy to start a secret society. They would all synthesize these secret teachings over in the cradle of civilization there. And we know all this. There was a guy, Al-Mazrizi, a 15th century historian, who put this all together. Now, Hassan Isabah, he was teaching the assassins in the secret little inner group all these initiation rituals. And the whole thing was a psyop. They would make the initiates doubt in the Prophet. They would make them doubt in the Holy Quran. They would say there's a hidden truth out there. But to get the secret truth, the student would have to be obedient to the teacher. This is very cult-like programming. But they would teach the numerology of Pythagoras. They would teach the Neoplatonism, which, again, these are all occult things. That's the foundation of occultism. They talked about Saturnian ideas as the Lord of Time, pantheism, this global consciousness stuff, how we're all connected, about how the forces of creation and destruction are all one. So is good and evil. It's all the same thing. Basically duality, which is a lot of the tones of Eyes Wide Shut, the film. And you can see how it pops up. It was a lot of like masculine feminine duality in Eyes Wide Shut. A lot of sex and death duality. And you can see that the origins of the assassins in this secret society, they talked about this too. And they were all about the Gnostic ideas, again, because it veers off into non-religion. Gnosticism, the salvation is found through the knowledge, the gnosis, not through faith in an organized religion. And when the initiate made it far enough, they would be told the truth that nothing is true. And in fact, everything is allowed. There's nothing bad. There's no God, there's no hell, there's no good, there's no evil. None of it matters. They rejected all the morals and all the rules. It was antinomianism. It was Satanism at its finest. The only belief they need was to follow the leader. Because to the pure, all things are pure. Which is exactly Ziegler's attitude. Remember? Remember Ziegler from Eyes Wide Shut? He was like, get Mandy out of here. I don't care. Oh, she's going to die? I don't care. I got what I needed out of her. Get her out of here. Because to the pure, all things are pure. The ends always justify the means to these weirdos. And Hassan Isabah taught them all these important lessons. And he would later become referred to as the old man of the mountain. And he was feared because of his group of killers, his brainwashed cult killers, just like Charles Manson. So they would coordinate assassinations in order to influence whatever, political, whatever's happening. And they would do psychological operations through this invisible empire they'd built, which included collecting intelligence. And they would collect the intelligence, like the blackmail, which they could leak it, they could sell it, they could reveal it, all this stuff, which is very Epstein-like, right? Which, if you recall, when I did the bonus show on Lolita, Kubrick was calling out the Zorro Ranch, essentially, in Lolita. And he was calling out the furniture, people use this furniture for sex, which is what you see in Eyes Wide Shut. But the big part about the assassins, it's all about psychological control, and this was part of their initiation rituals. So, I would argue, this reference in the book, which shows up in the film, Kubrick knew what was up with it. He knew that the secret society, 1,000 years ago, were perfecting the psychological operations, the initiation rituals, the blackmailing of stuff. And that's what you see in the film. Now, if you're curious as to what happened, the group splintered off more. One leader was Alauddin Aladdin. Like the Disney Aladdin, right? He was actually the second to last leader of the assassins. And they fell apart when the Mongols started going to war with them. And Bill Cooper talked about the assassins in his Mystery Babylon shows. And he says that the assassins were led by Muhammad's second son to conceal the secret religion. And he died and gave control over to Aladdin. But Aladdin, he was too young and too dumb. And Aladdin was only able to lead the assassins for 1,001 nights, which is where the book title came from. And this book is referenced in the first line of this book, Dream Novella. So, did Arthur Schnitzler know all this? No clue. But it is curious that Kubrick captured this in the film, when Malik's daughter whispers this part in his ear. He purposefully draws the viewer in to think, what the heck did she just say to him? Turn on the subtitles. Pay attention. Specifically calling this out. Specific. Why does she say that? It was a mystery, which we have decoded and revealed. But this is the last thing. She tells him this right before he goes to the orgy ritual, which supports the idea that this was all a psychological operation. He's being initiated. This is part of the blackmail, maybe. Either way, he's in touch with a secret society that knows the techniques of psychological operations and initiations. And that's the cue right before he shows up at the house. That's the last thing you hear. Pretty wild, right? And we're not even on the past the first page. My goodness. So, and much like the movie, you know, it progresses. The Fredelin's wife, Albertina, she's again dropping the news on him about how she has this lust for a stranger. Just like Alice and Dr. Bill, she tells him about how she was wearing a white rose to entice this guy, this Danish military officer. Now, what's curious is because she was trying to entice this guy, even though she was married to Fridolin at the time. Again, drawing the ideas of marriage and lust for others. But the white rose is a symbol of purity. And you actually see this in the Hunger Games. But in this case, it's a little different. Because what follows, instead of like in the movie, Dr. Bill hears the story and he's just like sitting there stunned. In the story, Fridolin, he responds with his own lusting. And boy, oh boy, is it something else. I'm going to read to you. She was a very young girl, perhaps 15 years old, with tousled blonde hair which flowed down over her shoulders and on one side across her tender breast. So basically, Fridolin was turned on by a 15-year-old girl, and in Eyes Wide Shut, that's the, I would argue, Malik's daughter at Rainbow Fashions. And Alice's male suitor, the Danish military guy, was pretty accurate to the movie, but Dr. Bill reveals he was lusting after this 15-year-old, which, again, I mean, this is 100 years ago. I don't know. Maybe it was more acceptable. Maybe it was more normalized. Either way, a little creepy, but let's keep it moving. So the Dr. Fridolin, he's got to go visit the dying man, and I'm going to read you from it. It says, Fridolin reached the street and unbuttoned his fur coat. It had already begun to thaw. The snow on the sidewalk had almost melted away, and a breath of the coming spring was blowing in the air. So what that means, this is not Christmas time like it is in Eyes Wide Shut, which is kind of odd, right? But, you know, maybe there's some cinematic directorial ideas of why that happened. But regardless, just wanted to point out it's actually Easter time, which is like the fertile, there's like sexual sort of tones to Easter, which would have made more sense in Eyes Wide Shut, maybe. So Fridolin does this thing at the house with Marianne, which is the crone. Again, she's like in love with him. He's a little more intrigued by her in the book than the movie. But he leaves. And when he leaves, here's an interesting part of the book. He's walking down the street. And this is the part where, in the movie, the Yale frat boys call him homosexual and bully him a little bit. In the book, it says this. When the light of a street lamp illuminated them, he recognized the Alemanni blue caps they wore. So, a little different, right? Because Schnitzler isn't referencing Yale here. He's referencing a different frat. Okay. Fair enough. But what's curious, listen to this. Only the last one behind them, a tall fellow with an open winter coat and a bandage over his left eye, was deliberately left a bit behind. So one of the frat boys had a covered left eye. There's a little bit of a eyes wide shut reference there, a little bit of all-seeing eye reference there, maybe. I don't know. How crazy do you want to get? But then Friedlin, he comes across Mitzi. She's the prostitute, right? This is Domino from the movie. And she says, he asks her how old she is. She says, 17. She said, sat on his lap and wrapped her arm around his neck like a child. Gross, right? She's only 17. So we've got a couple instances of underage sex and Friedlin here in the book that is not necessarily in the movie. But after he's done not banging the prostitute, he goes to the coffee house. This is probably analogous to the Sonata Cafe. And he's reading the newspaper and he reads a story about someone throwing vitriol on their friend. Now, vitriol is a Freemasonic reference. If you know about the reflection chambers in which the initiates sit in to reflect upon death, they have vitriol written on the wall. And it's an alchemical term for green glass or the green lion, used to create the Philosopher's Stone. And you'll see the green lion in symbols eating the sun. This represents the purification of the candidate when they do the work to go inside of themselves and reflect upon death. Because again, it could just be this whole thing is a ritual. He looks up from his newspaper. He sees a man staring at him. It's Natty Gale. And this is, of course, our introduction to Nick Nightingale, right? They have the conversation about the orgy thing, right? they don't call it the orgy, but I'll read you from the book. Nick says, or Nightingale, excuse me, says, but when you have four children to look after and a wife in Lviv, and he laughed again, but it was not quite as funny as before. But sometimes I do some things in private, he quickly added, and when he saw a reminiscent smile on Friedland's face, not among bank directors' houses and such, but in all possible circles, even the grimmer public and secret ones. Secret? Friedlin asked. Nightingale's eyes were dark and whistling. They'll be back for me in a minute. Are you playing somewhere else at this late hour? Yes, but it doesn't start there until 2. So again, we've got the same time reference, 2 a.m., meaning the Gnostic orgy mass reaches peak performance at 3 a.m. And then he's talking about it. He says, what do you mean? I don't know what for. Really, I don't know. I play blindfolded. Nightingale, what do you mean? Nightingale sighed. Unfortunately, my eyes are not completely blindfolded. Occasionally, I can still see something. I look in the mirror through the black silk cloth over my eyes. And again, he was silent. So we find out Nightingale is, in fact, got his eyes covered. Again, this is the Freemasonic hoodwink, covering the eyes. The hood, meaning the cover. The wink, meaning closing the eyes. And this represents, in the initiation, in the rituals, symbolically represents ignorance. It represents the darkness. The candidate must remove the blindfold before they can be exposed to the truth, to the illumination. This is part of the isolation ritual component. To suppress the ego, right? So they talk about how Friedlin needs to get his costume, and he tells him to go to the Cafe Vindabona, which is where there's a costume place right above it. Obviously not called Rainbow Costumes. That's a Kubrick thing. But what does Vindabona mean? It's the Roman military base. Nothing to do with rainbows. So again, Kubrick fabricated the rainbow aspect of the movie. Now when Friedland gets to the costume shop, the Cafe Voner Boner, the guy who answers is not named Malik, it's Mr. Gibbizer. I don't know. Who cares? And he leads Friedland up a spiral staircase into the store. Now, how curious is this, right? You've already heard my spiel about Charles Manson and the spiral staircase. But what about you? I feel like, what's that meme? You've heard of Elf on the Shelf. Now heard of Spiral Staircase in the book. Because in the movie, how curious is it that at the Ziegler party, at the beginning of the movie, Dr. Bill is led up the stairs, the spiral staircase, by those two old creepers that end up abducting their daughter Helena at the end of the movie. What's up with the spiral staircase? I don't know. But much like in the movie, they get up there and I'm going to read to you again. Well, they come across the two Asian men in the movie, right? They're banging Malik's daughter. It says, two men dressed in red robes of vehemic judges arose from the two chairs beside the table while at the same time a delicate, bright little girl disappeared. So in this scene, they are now wearing red vehemic judge robes. Okay? And after this breaks up, Gibbsier asks Friedland, he says, sir, would you like a cassock, a pilgrim's hat, and a mask? And the daughter, the pirouette, she says, no, you must give this gentleman an ermine coat and a red silk doublet. So you can see that Kubrick sort of combined that. I mean, he had the ermine reference, but he references the first line of the book from 1001 Nights in this scene. So he gets the costume. He meets up with Natty Gale, and Natty Gale tells him the password is Denmark. It's not Fidelio, it's Denmark. Now, this fits more into the ideas that this whole thing was a dream, because Denmark references where the military officer was from, that his wife wants to make sexy time with. Either way, you know, Fidelio references the Beethoven play and fidelity, whereas this references infidelity as well with Denmark, meaning the guy, the Danish military officer. So Friedland gets the password. He shows up at the place, and there's a little bit of risque stuff here. Like, they're talking about how, you know, Friedland notices that he was the only one who was wearing a hat, and he takes it off. Now, blah, blah, blah. A strange, sultry fragrance, as if from a Mediterranean garden, enveloped him. Again, an arm touched him. Now it was that of a nun. Like the others, she too had a black veil covering her face, head, and neck, and beneath the black laces of the mask shone a blood-red mouth. Where am I? Thought Friedland. Among lunatics? Or conspirators? Have I fallen into a meeting of some religious sect? So, I mean, there's hints of it being a sort of Gnostic mass, I guess, or a secret society. There's hints of it. And another part, Friedland notices Natty Gale at the piano. Says, all women stood motionless, all with dark veils over their heads, faces, and necks, and black lace masks over their eyes, but otherwise completely naked. So, again, there are references to this, but Kubrick really amped up the occult sort of vibe of this scene in the movie. So there are some vibes of ceremonial naked women. He meets, you know, he has the woman who comes and warns him that he should leave. And he asks, he says, do you mean there are no secret chambers here where couples who have found each other stay? Will all these people just say goodbye to each other with gentle hand kisses? It doesn't look like that at all. He pointed to the couples with glowing white bodies nestled against the silk of their partners, continued dancing in the overly bright mirrored room, blah, blah, blah. He felt as if no one cared about him and the woman next to him. They stood all alone in the almost dark middle hall. She whispers, "You are wishing in vain. There are no rooms here like you dream of. It is your last opportunity. Leave." So in the book, he thinks there's sexy time at the party. The woman asserts that is not the case. The book doesn't confirm any of the sex. There's no orgy scene. There's no Gnostic mass. Kubrick embellished all of this from the book. But Friedlin, he's trying to get to the bottom of the whole thing, and he's talking to the woman, and I'm going to read you another passage. He touched the veil, which was wrapped around her head as if he wanted to pull it down. She grabbed his hands. "It was one night when it happened, one of the men tried to pull the veil from one of us while dancing. They tore the mask from his face and whipped him out." "And she?" "You may have read about a beautiful young girl just a few weeks ago who took poison the day before her wedding." He remembered even the name and mentioned it. "Wasn't it a girl of a noble family who was engaged to an Italian prince?" She nodded. Now, this is just like in Eyes Wide Shut. When I'm confusing the name, Bill, when old Tom Cruise there reads the newspaper about Mandy dying, Amanda Curran dying. The elites own the mainstream media. They can twist the truth into whatever works. How far does that go? I don't know. But I do know that it's referenced in this book that the elites at this party are connected and can control reality. But nonetheless, Friedlin gets called out. And they ask him for the password. He doesn't know it. And we find out that the guy who calls him out is wearing a white robe. And it's a guy in a red robe, a red-dressed gentleman, who merely chimes in on the Inquisition. So it's not necessarily the red cloak. That was probably done for effect, I would imagine, in the movie. Just a thing to talk about, right? Just something to bring up. But, you know, Freeland's getting called out. And the woman reveals that she's going to save him. Says here, Friedlin stood motionless. "In what way shall this woman release me?" he asked. No one answered. Friedlin saw hands were pointing to the door as a sign he should leave immediately. Friedlin shook his head. "Do as you please, gentlemen. I will not tolerate this woman paying for me." "You wouldn't change anything about the fate of this woman," said the black gentleman gently. "If a promise was made here, there's no turning back." The nun nodded slowly as if to confirm. "Go," she said to Friedlin. So in the book, Friedlin is a bit more brave, a bit more assertive that he is not going to allow this woman to do it. But they force him out, and he's left wondering what's going on here. And he says, "But what reason did she have to sacrifice herself for him?" To sacrifice? Was she a woman for whom what was in store for her and what she now had to endure meant a sacrifice? If she took part in these societies, and it could not be the first time today, since she was so initiated into the rules, what change could it make if she belonged to one of the gentlemen or to all? Yes, could she be anything other than a prostitute? Could all these women be something else? Prostitutes? No doubt about it. Even if they all led some second bourgeois life, so to speak, besides this one, which was a whore's life. And wasn't everything, isn't that a Disney movie, A Bug's Life? Whore's life. Ugh. Anyway. And wasn't everything he had just experienced just a shameful joke? A joke that had already been planned, prepared, and possibly even rehearsed when an uninvited person sneaked in? Well, that's curious, right? Because the idea is that's an initiation ritual, and that's kind of what he's saying in this. That's what he's thinking in the book. The carriage picks him up, and he's wondering. He says, where was the carriage supposed to take him? Was the comedy supposed to be continued elsewhere? And what kind of comedy was it supposed to be? A solution to the mystery, perhaps? A cheerful reunion in another place? A reward after passing the test? Admission to the secret society? So it seems pretty clear that The ideas presented in Eyes Wide Shut about a secret society are confirmed in the book. It's definitely on the table as a possibility here that this is a secret society. Now, what's curious, there's another element of this book, and again, due to the time frame, he was a doctor and he was treating a kid with diphtheria that morning, and he has to go home at this point. They kick him out of the secret society ritual orgy gangbang thing, and he says he's wondering about going home. He says, and again, he realized that he might already be carrying the germ of a fatal disease in his body. Wouldn't it be too silly to die from the fact that a child with diphtheria had coughed in your face? Perhaps he was already ill. Didn't he have a fever? Shouldn't he be lying in bed at home at this very moment? And all that he thought he had experienced had been nothing but deliriums? So right there, this passage, it argues that he was possibly exposed to diphtheria. Maybe he's already dead. Maybe he's dreaming. Maybe the initiation was facing death on another setting. Which, just like the movie, we talked about how it's a lot to do with sex and death. Is what the whole thing is about. And that's kind of what the book is about. So just like in the movie, Fridolin goes home. Albertine is, you know, in her sleep, and she wakes up. And listen to what she says. She says she had a dream. She said, all the other couples were also visible in this endless flood of nudity that surrounded me. You were standing in the courtyard of a castle. Then a young woman with a tiara on her head and in a purple dress appeared from a high-arched window between the red curtains. It was the queen of the country. She looked down at you with a sternly questioning look. You stood alone, and the many others were swept aside, pressed against the walls. I heard treacherous whispering and murmuring in a threatening manner. Then the queen bent over the railing. It became silent, and the queen gave you a sign as if she were commanding you to come up to her. And I knew that she decided to pardon you. But you didn't notice her or didn't want to see her. Suddenly, you were now wrapped in a black cloak. You were standing in front of her with your hands tied. You were not in a room, but somehow floating in the air. She was holding a piece of parchment in her hand. It was your death sentence, which also recorded your guilt and the reasons for your conviction. She asked you, I didn't hear the words, but I knew it was so, whether you were ready to become her lover, in which case you will be exempted from the death penalty. You shook your head in denial. I was not surprised, for it was perfectly expected and certain that you have to remain faithful to me at all risk and all eternity. Then the princess shrugged, waved her hand, and there you suddenly found yourself in an underground cellar, and whips whizzed around you. Now, her dream was very similar to the dream that Alice had in Eyes Wide Shut of the woman saving him and the orgy house and all that. But it also brings up the ideas of fidelity and cheating in marriage and all that stuff that you see in the movie. So again, the book is very similar to the movie, very true to the themes presented. And she goes on and on about this dream. I'll cut out a couple pages here. She says, but you greeted me smiling with your eyes as if to show that you had fulfilled my wish and brought me everything I needed, clothes, shoes, and jewelry. But I thought your actions were exceedingly foolish and senseless and it tempted me to mock you, to laugh in your face, precisely because you, out of loyalty to me, refused the queen's offer and instead endured torture and now came up here staggering to suffer a terrible death. I ran towards you, and you two were walking faster and faster. I began to float, and you two were floating. Then I lost sight of you, and I realized we had just flown past each other. So in her dream, he gave her all the material wealth stuff, which is what you see in the movie. Alice lives a pretty comfortable life. So in the book, he provides everything for her, and he doesn't sexy time with the queen. He suffered, he's working, he's toiling for his woman. But she laughs in his face. Cold-blooded. So that all goes down. The next morning, just like in the movie, he goes to revisit all the places he had been the night prior. He goes to try to find Nick, or Mr. Nottingale, excuse me. And he tries to slip a letter to the concierge. This is the dude at the hotel, right? But two gentlemen are there and they stop it. It makes no mention of two large penis men like they do in the movie with the possibly gay front desk man. In fact, it's a very short passage. It's actually a much longer scene in the movie, right? So he goes on and he's like, I'm going to go find the orgy house. And he has some weird thoughts. Let's read from the book. He says, after all, he neither had the time nor probably the talent to carry out all the necessary investigations. A secret society? Well, it is a secret anyway, but don't they know each other? Aristocrats? Perhaps even members of the court? He thought of certain archdukes who were capable of such behavior. So he's recalling the night, and he specifically thinks this is a secret society. And he's wondering if they sacrificed the woman or if it was all for show. But either way, you hear him talk about the aristocrats. These are the elites. So yes, Kubrick knew that he was calling out the elites in the movie, right? Then he says, but the woman who sacrificed herself to him? Sacrificed? Why had he kept imagining that it had really been a sacrifice? That's impossible. Of course it was just a prank. So we've got the idea of the blood sacrifice by the secret society. And again, like, people think that it's conspiracy crazy talk to talk about how the movie is really about the Illuminati and the blood sacrifices, but it's lifted directly from the book. Yes, Kubrick's talking about it. But yeah, he gets to the house. Again, he gets the note where they're like, you better leave us alone. You better quit investigating. Get the hell out of here. And he's like, oh, okay, fine. And he keeps it moving. He goes out to the Crone's house where the woman, her father, was dying. He says, as he looked up at Marianne's window, her image, which had faded entirely, came to life again, more than that of all the others. Well, he could begin his work of revenge here without any particular effort. Talking about cheating on Albertina because she was being trifling, trying to sleep with the Danish military guy. He said there was no difficulty or danger for him, and that which others might have been afraid of, the betrayal of her fiancé, made him even keener. Yes, to betray, cheat, and lie, and play a prank in front of Marianne, in front of Albertina, in front of this good Dr. Roediger, in front of the whole world. To lead a kind of double life, to be capable, reliable, promising doctor, the good husband, father of the family, and at the same time to be a libertine, a seducer, a cynic, who played with people, with men and women, just as his impulse suited him. At the time, that seemed to be of... I screwed it up. I was good, all the way good until the last sentence. At the time, that seemed to him to be particularly delightful. So he's contemplated cheating on Albertina. He feels utterly betrayed by her. It's almost as if she had the affair, just because she was talking about it. She was being open and honest about her fantasies, but he was like, nah, too much. I'm going to bang this chick. I'm going to throw it all away. And what he's talking about, because Schnitzler was buddies with Freud, we got to talk about the superego, the ego, and the id. The id, that's your libido. Libido. Right? That's your instincts. That's your reptile way of being that you just want to, you know, sex and kill everything. Then you got the ego. That's your built-up construct of the world, of the world around us. That's the rules given to you, the morals given to you from society. And then you, I'm sorry, that was a superego. I'm looking at my notes here. Sorry. Then you've got the, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so the superego gives you all the rules and stuff. But then you got the ego, and that's the mediator between the two that says, okay, society tells me I shouldn't sleep with this woman because I'm married, I'm a doctor, I'm a father. I shouldn't do it. But the id is like, dude, do it, banger. And then you got the ego in between the two. And this whole story is the struggle of Friedland's ego undoing what he thinks he should do. Quite the conundrum, my friends. But just like in the movie, he doesn't quite seal the deal. He keeps him moving. He's like, you know what? I'm going to go visit the prostitute. And he goes over there and let's see here. Should this experience be another, the last sign that everything had to fail him? Why? That him escaping a great danger could be a good sign after all? And was escaping the danger all that mattered? All sorts of other things were probably still in store for him. he never thought of giving up his search for the wonderful woman from last night. So he's revisiting the three women. This is like, again, like Christmas Carol. It's like Scrooge, right? Marianne, he's like, I'm just going to bang her. She wants it. But she's moving away, and he's like, nah, I'm not really going to do it. Goes to visit the prostitute, Mixie, that's Domino, but she's in the hospital. Much like we find out that Domino has HIV, Mixie, she's in the hospital. So that leaves us with the goddess at the party. He's like, I'm gonna do that chick. That's who I'm doing. But I gotta find her. How am I gonna find her? So that's where he's at right now. So he stops in at a cafe because he's gotta fuel up, man. He's gotta get some caffeine going because he's about to throw down. Okay. He's like, I'm gonna find this girl. We're about to throw down. And he gets a newspaper and it says, this morning, in a distinguished hotel in the inner city, a woman had poisoned herself. A remarkably pretty lady. I don't know what newspaper this is, but okay. That's pretty subjective. It says, the latter had stayed there a few days under the name of Baroness de Friedelin immediately, this immediately felt a strange suspicion. The lady had come home at 4 o'clock in the morning, accompanied by two gentlemen who said goodbye to her at the gate. 4 o'clock? That's what he's thinking in his head. 4 o'clock? Just at the hour when he had also reached home. And around noon, she had been found unconscious in her bed with signs of severe poisoning. A strikingly beautiful young lady. Well, there were some remarkably beautiful young ladies. He's referring to, like, I'm trying to read and interpret for you. He's thinking about the house, right? The orgy house. There was no reason to assume that Baroness D, but rather the lady who stayed at the hotel under the name of Baroness D, and a certain other lady, were one and the same person. And yet, his heart was pounding, and the paper shook in his hand. In a distinguished city hotel, which one? Why so mysterious? Why so discreet? So he does a little more investigation, but alas, he goes to the morgue, and yes, she's definitely dead. So now he's like, again, just like in the movie, he's sort of scared straight, we'll say. And he's like, okay, I guess I'm not going to do this cheating thing. And he goes home, just like in the movie. And when he goes home, he sees the mask on the pillow. Right from the book, it says, the way she placed the mask on his pillow made him understand that it signifies the face of her husband, who had become an enigma to her. This playful, almost joking manner seemed to express both a mild warning and her willingness to forgive. So, much like in the movie, they have to rekindle and reconcile what is going on here. So they're up all night, till the morning, talking. And I'm going to read you the final passage. This is at the end of the book. She says, she smiled, and after a moment's hesitation, she replied, to be grateful to fate, I believe that we have escaped unharmed from all our adventures, whether they were real or only a dream. Are you certain of that? He asked. So sure that I know the reality of one night, even that of a whole lifetime, is not the whole truth. And no dream, he sighed softly, is entirely a dream. She took his head in both hands and embraced it tightly to her breast. Now we are awake, she said, for a long time to come. He wanted to add, forever. But before he uttered the words, she put her finger on his lips and whispered, as if to herself, never ask about the future. So what's going on here? We've got another reconciliation story. They both decide they're not going to satisfy their lustful ways. They're going to stay together. They're going to stay together forever, maybe. But that's scary to her. She's scared of the idea of staying together forever. She doesn't want to be the Friedelin that long. She's like, let's just take it one day at a time. Chill, bro. Like, and maybe that's the narrative on marriage. Like, why put all this pressure behind it? Like, doesn't that make it more difficult? Shouldn't we have marriages that are just one-year licenses, and every year you decide whether you want to re-up or not? Right? Is that not a better answer? No, I don't know. But yeah, there's pressure behind the social construct of marriage, and that social construct, the superego, is in conflict with the id, the instinctual libido, and that's what the struggle's all about. But you got all this secret society stuff going on in the tale, but for sure, all this stuff found its way into Kubrick's movie. But Kubrick emphasized a lot of interesting ideas, because in the book, there's no talk about the rainbow, but it's all in the movie. In the movie, it's not specified all this sexual undertones towards younger women. In the movie, the male sexual interest of the wife is a Navy officer, but in the book, he's in the Danish military, which, again, like I told you, that's L. Ron Hubbard, right? The password isn't Fidelio, it's Denmark. And in the book, there's no orgy scene. There's no Gnostic mass. Kubrick embellished all of that into the movie. Why? Because he knew. And then we confirm that Kubrick was laying out this symbolism, this theme of occultism. Because it's in the book. In the book, they're telling us there is blood sacrifice rituals at these gatherings of the secret societies of the elite aristocrats. It's in the book. That's what Kubrick's shown us in the movie. That's no conspiracy theory. That's the reality of what Kubrick showed us in his final film. All right, my friends. I hope you enjoyed that bonus episode. I got another one for you, though. How deep you want to go? How many levels of Inception do you want to go on Eyes Wide Shut? Because we're going to go even deeper. I read a book called Stanley Kubrick and the Making of His Final Film by Robert Kolker and Nathan Abrams. And this is about as intense of a read in the details of how this movie was made as you could ever ask for. I'm going to walk you through the whole thing, though. I got notes on the whole thing, and we're going to have another good time, and we're going to talk even more about Eyes Wide Shut. You will be an expert on Eyes Wide Shut by the time these bonus episodes are over. So thank you for your support. If you're on the Rockfin, the Patreon, you're on the VIP section, wherever you're at, I appreciate your support. And until next time, stay woke.